going to learn about Shavuos. Shavuos is a yomtiv. It's a very interesting yomtiv that actually doesn't have any particular commandments. Every single holiday in Jewish life has something to do about it. Like Pesach, you have the matzah, and Sukkot, you have the sukkah, and all the kinds of things. Very interesting things. In Shavuos, you don't have anything. So that in itself has to be understood. Of course, we're going to talk about this later. First of all, I usually try, not always comes out, but whatever. I usually try to be ordered and very structured, because things like lay easier in the mind when you know each thing in its place. So what we're going to learn is like this. We're going to first of all understand what this Yom Tov, what this celebration actually means, what's the story behind it, like very, very basic things. I'll try to make the class in a way that those who don't know anything will learn something, and those who already know also will learn. So we're going to combine both ideas. So on first of all, we're going to learn historic ideas behind Shavuos. Second, we're going to read inside the Talmud itself some very scarce and some ideas that our sages say about Shavuos that I think is go they're going to be interesting. Then we're going to learn two specific mystical ideas, and then just what to do and what basically what to do in Shavuos. What is it all about? So let's start. First of all, let's go with the historic facts. Shavuos happened around 3,360 something years ago. I put the year over there before Common Era, which in itself it's a teaching that we have to like get used to. We always, when using the regular calendar, not the Jewish calendar, regular calendar, we usually use before Common Era. We don't say before this guy, after this guy, whatever. We don't use that. We say Common Era. And of course, they actually mean the same thing, but we just don't want to, mention, et cetera, et cetera. So we use this. In the year 1313 before Common Era, the Jewish people left Egypt. This happened in the 15th of Nisan. Even if you don't really understand and know all the names of the months in Hebrew, don't worry, it's not necessary. Actually, there's only one month that I'm not mentioning over here, but don't worry, it's not really important. The point is that there's a day in the calendar we left Egypt. 7 days after leaving Egypt, I'm not going to go into the story of Egypt because that belongs to Pesach, so to speak, to a different holiday. A few days afterwards, we went on the Red Sea and we left definitely Egypt. Now, as soon as Pesach, so to speak, ended, we started. I mean, that means the second day after Pesach. I'm sorry, second day after Pesach, we started counting the Omer. This is a whole thing in itself. It's a whole one mitzvah or 48 mitzvot commandments. Doesn't really matter right now. We just finished. Actually, this night we counted the 49th day, and after these 49 days, they count comes the 6th of Sivan. And that's the Yom Tov of Shavuos. What I want to show, so to speak, in this specific part of the class, just a second. What I want to show in this specific part of the class is that there's a continuation, a projection from Pesach until Shavuos. In fact, when God told Moses to go take out the Jewish people from Egypt, He told him, look, the reason why I want these people to go out of Egypt is because they will receive the Torah in Mount Sinai. That means, like, the completion, the end of Pesach is actually Shavuos. You don't have one without the other, to the point that Shavuos doesn't have a day, specific day in the calendar. All the Jewish holidays have a day. This day we do this, like 15th of Nisan is Pesach, the 15th of Tishrei is Sukkot, the 1st of Tishrei is Rosh Hashanah, the 10th of Tishrei is Yom Kippur, whatever the holidays are, doesn't really matter. But Shavuos doesn't have a day. Doesn't have a day. When do we celebrate Shavuos? 49 days, that means the 50th day after Pesach. That shows us that even in the scripture, they're really, really connected, very, very deeply connected. Shavuos is the end of Pesach. Why did God take out the Jewish people from Egypt? In order to receive the Torah at Mount Sinai in Shavuos, as we're going to explain what this really means. But I'm just showing, like, in time, in history, they're really connected. Now, even though I could stop right now with the historic facts, I think it's very interesting to go a little bit further beyond Shavuos, so to speak, even though this is a class of Shavuos, but it doesn't matter. You're going to understand. You're going to understand. Beyond Shavuos, to understand basically how facts are divided in the Torah. We said, again, Nisan is the going out of Egypt, departure from Egypt. Then we went through the sea. As soon as we left Egypt, we started counting the Omer, 49 days. Then comes Shavuos. The next day, after Shavuos, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Mount Sinai to receive the tablets. That means Shavuos, basically what happened there is that God revealed himself, showed himself. I don't know exactly what they saw, but whatever. Like around 3 million people, more or less, were standing on the surface, so to speak, of Mount Sinai, down in Mount Sinai, and they saw something, whatever that is. This is what Shavuos means. And God said, "I'm here. I'm God. I'm your God. Don't have other gods." 10 commandments, 10 different ideas that God said. Okay. Next day, Moshe said, "Okay, God wants to give us tablets. That actually they were square tablets. It's a whole thing in itself. I'm not going to explain that now. But the point is that Moshe spent 40 days and 40 nights in Mount Sinai, receiving the first tablets." Then he comes down in the 17th of Tammuz, of course, 40 days after Shavuos, and the Jewish people were doing the golden calf. They were doing idolatry. Like 40 days after receiving the Torah, that means after seeing God, whatever they saw, they were already doing idolatry. One small note on this idea. The Talmud says, our sages explain that idolatry was something so with such a deep pleasure. Of course, the people that were doing idolatry had such a deep pleasure that wasn't such a simple thing just to live out. Today, in the world we live today, the way we live today, etc., it doesn't really fit our minds how these people could do such a thing. They saw God, and 40 days afterward they were doing idolatry. Like, we don't understand this. Why? Because this is what our sages say in the Talmud. The people of the great assembly, that means the era of the second temple, they prayed to God to take out the pleasure that generated idolatry. It was like a pleasurable thing to bow down to some idol over there. They have pleasure in that. It's difficult for us to understand that maybe, and just a very simple example, just as a person has pleasure eating chocolate, oh, what a nice chocolate from Switzerland, and I don't know what. The same way people had pleasure doing idolatry. But that's one small note on trying to understand why these people actually did the golden calf and they served the golden calf. There's a whole bunch of stories and ideas that we could actually share about the golden calf. I'm not going to do that, maybe in a different class. But the point is that, again, 40 days and 40 nights after receiving the Torah, that means seeing God, etc., etc., the Jewish people are doing the golden calf. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, comes down from Mount Sinai with the tablets and sees what the people are doing, and he breaks the tablets. He breaks them. One very simple explanation of why he broke them is because the tablets were like the marriage contract between the Jewish people and God. And the Jewish people now were like with another man. Like, God is the man, we Jewish people are the woman. So we were hanging around with another man. So Moshe said, look, at least let them not be married. So he broke the contract. They're not married, so they didn't do anything wrong. This is one very simple explanation. But the point is, the fact is, that they were doing idolatry with the golden calf. Moshe Rabbeinu takes care of this, destroys the golden calf. Many, many people die because of the idolatry, etc., etc. Moshe Rabbeinu the next day goes up to Mount Sinai again to ask forgiveness for the Jewish people. 40 days, 40 nights, God wanted to destroy the Jewish people and make a whole new people from Moshe. Many, many stories. This is all in Parshas Kisisa in the Torah. 40 days and 40 nights afterwards, God forgave. That was the first day of the month of Elul, towards the end of the Jewish year. First of all, Rosh Chodesh Elul. Moshe comes down from Mount Sinai saying, God forgave. We're fine. He decided he's not going to destroy us. Very nice, but we don't have any tablets. We don't have any proof of the covenant that God made with the Jewish people in Mount Sinai in the original moment of giving of the Torah. That's why the next day, the second day of Elul, Moshe goes up again to receive the second tablets, 40 days, 40 nights, and comes down in the 10th of Tishrei, that is Yom Kippur. Why is Yom Kippur fixed as a day of atonement, a day of repentance, a day of forgiveness, etc., etc.? Because that day shows the complete forgiveness of God for the Jewish people. Because not only he decided not to destroy us after the whole story of the golden calf, but also he gave us the tablets, the second tablets that were different than the first ones. I'm not going to go into the differences right now. But the main difference was that the first tablets were carved by God. Second tablets were carved by ours, by Moshe. Different things. But the point is that this is the proof of God's forgiveness. Then next year, that's what I wrote in the end of the slide, year 1312 before the Common Era, the Jewish people built the Mishkan, the tabernacle, finishing the idea of bringing down God into this earth. Why am I adding this? And why do I call it the next year? Because the truth is that the Jewish year starts and ends in Nisan. That's the first month. So even though this could in itself take a whole class, even though we usually count the first day of the year in Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, but the truth is that now, the year starts in Nisan. That's why when the Jewish people built the tabernacle, like showing complete forgiveness because God decided to dwell down here in the tabernacle, he was revealed over there. That happened in the first day of Nisan, and that's the second year after the Jewish people left Egypt. This is a very like brief, concise show of the facts, historic facts. Where is Shavuos in all of this thing? Shavuos is in the same year that the Jewish people left Egypt, 49 days after, I mean, the day at number 50th, the 50th day, 49 days after the Jewish people left Egypt, that's Shavuos. That's the giving of the Torah. This is the main thing of Shavuos. Let's move on. We're going to learn now a few things in the Talmud. I know that there's a lot of Hebrew over there. I'm not expecting you to read any of it. Don't worry, the Hebrew is for me. I just wanted to show you, like, to read from the inside, even though I put some English, very, very brief summaries. But I thought it was interesting to see, like, the precise language of our sages. It's interesting. Let's start from the beginning. Just a second, because okay, I just moved the cameras a little bit. Okay, let's go. I'm not going to read the Hebrew itself. I'm just going to translate in English, and whatever, my English is not the best and it's not perfect, but I hope you'll understand. There was a man from Galilee, which means the north of Eretz Israel, that was teaching in front of Rav Chisda, one big sage in the Talmud. And he said something like that. And Rav Chisda was like very happy when he heard this, because he said like, wow, this is a good teaching. This guy explained like this. We don't know the name. That's why he's called like just a man from Galilee. He said like this. Blessed is God that he gave a threefold Torah to a threefold people through a threefold person. I just didn't put it in English over there. In a threefold day. In a threefold month. What does that mean? The idea is like this. Why is it a threefold Torah? Because Torah is, it has three parts: Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim. Torah means like the five books of Moses. Then Nevi'im is, and I don't remember exactly the number, but it's a number of books of prophets and a number of writings. All of them together is 24 books of the Tanakh, the Bible, so-called Bible, whatever you want to call it. So this is why it's called threefold: Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim. Then you have a threefold people because it's Koyanim, Levim, and Israelim. Most of us, I'm included, Rav Asher not, he's a Koyan, but most of us come from Israel and from like different tribes that we don't know exactly which tribe we're talking about. But whatever case is, we're a threefold people, so to speak. Through a threefold person, that's Moshe, because he was the third child. The first one was Miriam. The second one was Aaron, and then Moshe Rabbeinu. He was a third child. That's why the threefold. In a threefold day, the threefold day was because there were 3 days that God told Moses to tell the Jewish people to separate from their women in order to receive the Torah, to sanctify themselves to receive the Torah. So the Torah was given in the third day after this separation. Then you have that's the threefold day. Then the threefold month is because Sivan is the third month of the year, Nisan, Iyar, then Sivan. So we see that the Torah is connected to the number three. This is one idea of the Talmud. So we see that everything is like connected, three, 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 etc., etc. Another teaching of the Talmud, just picking, like cherry picking, so to speak. There are many, many, many other things. Let's go. The Jewish people says the Torah in Parshas Yisro, which is the Parsha in the Torah, in the second book of the Torah that teaches us about the giving of the Torah. We see there's a verse that says that the Jewish people were standing betachtis ha'ar, which means literally under Mount Sinai. If you read, like simple reading means they were down. The mount is over here and they were over here, down. But if you really read it like very literally means that they were under the mountain. What do you mean? Under, nobody's under the mountain. So says Rav Avdimi Bar Chama, says like this. This teaches us, what does it mean that the Torah says that the Jewish people were standing really under the mountain? This teaches us that God left up the mountain, lifted up the mountain, and said to the Jewish people, look, if you receive the Torah, fine, everything is okay. But if you don't receive it, that's going to be your burial place. Just going to put the mountain down, and that's it. You're out. This is what Rav Avdimi taught. Then, continuing, Rav Achbar Yaakov taught something more. From here, you can learn that we could actually complain and say we did not accept the Torah because we wanted to accept it. Forget it. I'm able not to fulfill any of this. I was forced. This is what Rav Chama says. Rav Acham Bar Yaakov says. However, in a later generation, Rove, another sage in the Talmud, says, "Yeah, you're right." However, there's another story in the Torah itself that shows us how the Jewish people accepted the Torah by themselves without being forced. In the story of Purim, I'm not going to go into the whole story of Purim, but the point is in that story that if the Jewish people would have said, "Okay, you know what? We don't want the Torah. We don't want to be Jewish. We don't want to be called Jewish. Forget it. We're just going to mix within all the other nations." Haman, which is like the character of Purim, trying to destroy the Jewish people, he would have said, "Okay, then it's fine. My problem with you, Jews, is that you're like separated from other people. You're just one thing by itself. Why don't you mix with anybody else?" So if we would have mixed, nobody would have passed away. But we didn't do that. We accepted the Torah, even though we were not forced to. In the giving of the Torah itself, in Shavuos, we were quote unquote forced to accept the Torah. However, in the story of Purim, many, many years after the giving of the Torah, we actually accepted because we want it. That's why we're not like Potter. We're not exempt of keeping the Torah, even though we were forced on the first place. In the first place, Hasidic teaching teaches us that what does that mean that God put the mountain on top of the people? Like, sounds really weird. What this means is God showed us a tremendous love. So powerful was it that we could not say no, so to speak. So we accepted the title. That's just another way of looking at things. But this is another story in the Talmud. Let's go for the third one. Says Reish Lakish, another very interesting character in the Talmud. Says Reish Lakish like this: why is it written in the beginning of the creation, in the relation when the Torah describes the creation, it was night, it was morning, the sixth day. In all the other days, it's not written like the number day, day one, day two, day three. When it comes to the sixth day, the Torah says the sixth day. Why is there a difference in the Hebrew? If you know Hebrew, it's just a letter. The difference is the letter hey. Okay, I'm sorry. But whatever, the letter hey and hashishi. Why is it written like that? Like that? What's this letter coming to teach us? This teaches us that God made a condition with the whole creation. And the condition was like this: if the Jewish people receive and accept the Torah in Shavuos, so the world is going to continue existing. If the Jewish people do not accept it, I'm going to destroy the whole world. That's it. So that means, besides the story itself, besides the letter, hey, etc., etc., this shows that actually the whole world is waiting for us to accept the Torah. The whole world is waiting for us to keep the Torah, to love the Torah, to love God, to love another Jew, etc., etc. This is another part in the Talmud. Another story said Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar said like this: when the Jewish people were about to, in the previous days, to receive the Torah, the Jewish people said, "Naaseh v'nishma." We will do, and then we will learn, understand. When the Jewish people actually said this, was a very weird thing, because usually first you understand and then you do. How do you do without understanding? So the Jewish people said, whatever God says, we're going to accept it, and then we're going to try to understand it. When this happened in the previous days before Shavuos, came a voice from heavens, and the voice said, "Who revealed this secret to my children?" said God. "This is a secret that only the angels know." How do we know that the angels know this secret of doing and then actually understanding? Because the psalm says, I think it's 104, 103 or 4, the psalm says, "Baruch Hashem Malachav," bless God, the angels, his angels should bless him. Yivayre, they're really powerful. Oisei dvaro, the angels do what God says to do. Lishmoya called that dvaro, and then they listen to whatever God says. So first we see that the angels do, and then they try to understand. The same thing did the Jewish people when we received the Torah. This is a very fundamental teaching in general in Judaism. In the Hebrew, classic expression is Kabbalas Oil. We accept the yoke of heaven. That means we don't really ask why and how. We just do. If you don't know how to do, so we ask, of course. But the point is, we accept. This is a very fundamental characteristic in the Jewish thought, so to speak. Let's go. This one is longer, but I thought it was so beautiful that I just copied the whole thing. Now I'm going to read it to you, even though it's really long. I think it's a very, very interesting story. This whole story that we see over here, even if you don't know how to read the Hebrew, don't worry. But the point is, there's a discussion between Moshe Rabbeinu and the angels, if we would really receive the Torah or not. And the discussion is so interesting that I, again, decided just to copy the whole thing. Says Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, I'm going to read it to you. And in the moment that Moshe Rabbeinu went up in the heavens, the angels that were serving God, they had a complaint. They were not happy about this whole thing of Shavuos, of giving the Torah. They were completely not happy at all. And here comes a man, Moshe Rabbeinu, into the heavens, whatever that means, spiritual thing, material thing, I don't know, doesn't really matter. The point is that they saw Moshe and they complained to God. They said like this: "Master of the world, what is this guy doing here? This guy was born from a woman, from a regular woman, whatever, is a human being. What is he doing here?" So God said to them, he came to receive the Torah. That's why he came. So the angels answered, wait a second, your most secret and beautiful thing that you had for 974 generations before the world was created. And you want to give it to this guy, to flesh and blood? Forget it. It stays here, said the angels. It should stay in heavens. There's no reason why it should be in the earth. This is something so precious, so important, so holy. What is he going to do in the earth? This is what the angels say to God. They complain. Furthermore, there's a psalm that expresses what the angels were saying. Mo enesh kisiz kerenu, what's man in order to remember him? Question the angels, God. What's man? You have to think about him. Uven adam kisiv kerenu, the son of man, in order to remember him, to think about him, forget it. The angels continue even more. Furthermore, Hashem Adonainu, God, our master, how powerful is your name in the whole earth? Are you going to leave your glory in the heavens? So even though the psalm looks like a very simple praise to God, however, the psalmist expressing what the angel said when Moshe came to receive the Torah, leave your Torah in the heavens. Forget it, it's not for men. So what did God do? The angels had an actually interesting complaint, and it looks truthful. So God said to Moshe Rabbeinu, go answer them. You answer them. I'm not going to say anything. I'm the judge, you know? You go answer them. So Moshe said, master of the world, I'm afraid of them. Maybe they will burn me just from their mouth. They're going to talk and they're going to burn me. They're angels. I'm a regular human being. What do you want from me? I don't know how to answer them. So God said to Moshe, grab my throne, my throne of glory, and answer them. Don't worry. Just go answer them. Okay. How do you know this? And so the Talmud brings another verse that actually shows how when you hold, so to speak, to the holy throne, etc., you have strength. That's what the verse, whatever, expresses. So says Rabbi Nachum, this teaches us that actually there was a ray of power that came from God into Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu said like this, master of the world, the Torah that you want to give us, what is written in it? So God answered him, I'm God, your master, your Lord, whatever, that I took you out of Egypt. That's the first commandment. So Moshe Rabbeinu looked at the angels and said, did you go to Egypt? Did you ever go to Egypt? Did you ever wear servants to Pharaoh, to the king of Egypt? So why do you need the Torah for? Torah is not talking to you. So he continued. Again, looked at God. Again, what's the next one? What's more written? What's written over there? What's more? So God said, don't have any other gods. So Moshe looked at the angels and said, wait a second, did you ever went to the angels? Did you ever went into the other nations, between the other nations, that they do idolatry in order to have a whole phrase talking about not having other gods? No, you never went into other nations. What else is written over there? Remember the seventh day to sanctify it, Shabbos, to sanctify it. Do you ever do work? Asked Moshe Rabbeinu. You don't do work. You don't need to rest. What else is written over there? Don't mention the name of God in vain. Really? Do you actually have business that you have to swear in the name of God? You don't have any business. You don't have any worry that maybe somebody took something that doesn't belong to them. What else is written over there? Respect your father and your mother. Oh, really? Do you have a father and mother? Asked Moshe to the angels. What else is written over there? Don't kill. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Really? Said Moshe Rabbeinu to the angels. Do you have jealousy between each other? do you have a bad inclination within you? Immediately, the angels recognized that Moshe was right, and they said to God, you're right. God, our master, how beautiful, how powerful is your name, etc., etc. And they didn't say anymore, leave your glory in the heavens. So we see that there's the Torah, sometimes people think, wow, these commandments are so difficult. These commandments are so, so far from me. It's like really impossible. Wait a second. Torah was given to us. And this is what this story, even besides the funny aspect of the story, the discussion between Moshe, the angels, whatever, besides that fact, the story is very, very powerful. The idea is very powerful that the Torah is given to us recognizing what we are, recognizing our desires, recognizing our bad inclination, knowing God knows who is he giving the Torah to and for what. To the point that he says, don't kill. Most of the regular, normal people don't even think about it. Okay, there are some meshuggahs, there are crazy people around in the world, but most of the regular people don't, like, it's not me. You don't need to tell me not to kill anybody because, you know, I was not raised into that thinking. So why do you have to tell me this? Because besides the fact of the story, there are many ways of killing people, not just with a knife or whatever. Maybe you can kill a person by words. When you embarrass somebody in public, you're killing that person. So whatever, there are many, many lawyers to every idea. But the point is, the Torah has been given even to people that think about actually killing somebody, not just with words, you know, the regular way. Let's go to the last story, which is a very, very short one. The first word of the first commandment is in Hebrew, Anoichi. We're going to learn about this in a few minutes also, more information. The first word is Anoichi. Usually this word translates to me. Like, I'm God, your Lord, etc. I'm God, your Lord, etc., etc. So it's like me. However, the Talmud says, and the writings, whatever, in other places also, in the Midrash, says it's not really a Hebrew word. If you go in the streets in Israel right now and say, Anoichi, Anoichi, they're going to look at you like, what? Where do you come from? Like, how old are you? How many thousand years ago were you born? So nobody talks like this. It's not even a Hebrew word. So one of the explanations of this word is that it actually is a word comprised of four words. Each letter actually corresponds to a whole word in Aramaic. And these words, these four words, are Ana Nafshi Kesavis Yehovis. Says God, I myself, Ana is like me in Aramaic. Nafshi means my essence. Kesavis, in these writings, Yehavis, I gave myself. So the idea of Anoichi, the first word of the first of the Ten Commandments, is actually, at least one lawyer of understanding is, God saying to us, you want me? Take the Torah. By taking the Torah, by understanding the Torah, learning the Torah, you're actually taking me. This is a few ideas that appear in the Talmud regarding Shavuos. Let's go to some teachings a little bit deeper. Our sages teach, first I'm going to explain what we see in the slide. I think it's going to be easier if we go backwards. I put in this slide two ideas. First idea, you're going to see like it's two parts. First idea corresponds to the map of America that I put over there, North America, South America, whatever. And the second part is actually an explanation of a verse in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. The first part is going to help us understand the second part. And at the end of the slide, I put two drawings. One is perfume and the other one is oil. Why am I talking about this and what's the connection to Shavuos? Okay. This is my job to explain this. And the idea is like this. Our sages say in the Midrash that when God created the whole world, there was a decree. The decree was that the spiritual world was not able to reveal itself in the physical world. And same thing the other way around. The physical world was not able to raise up into the spiritual world. The way our sages explain this is with an example. There was a king that he had like two different parts of his kingdom, and there was a north and a south. The people from the north could not go to the south. The people from the south could not go to the north. There was a thing in the middle, like a cut in the middle. They were not able to go from one side to the other side. It came one day that the king decided to take out this interruption between the two sides, and the people from the north were able to go down to the south. The people from the south were able to go up to the north. Our sages connect this to say certain verses in Parshas Yisro, in the Parsha where the giving of the Torah is actually written, in the second book of the Torah, it's the book of Shmois. The Torah says that Moshe Rabbeinu went up into Mount Sinai and God went down into Mount Sinai. And actually, the order is that first God went down and then Moshe went up. This teaches us that there was like a connection between this lower world and the upper worlds. This is what the Midrash says. This is what our sages explain about what happened in Matan Torah, in the giving of the Torah in Shavuos. There was a connection between the spiritual and the material world. Okay, very nice. However, this has a very deep teaching to understand what Judaism is all about. And this, between this idea and the next one, is a combination. That's why I chose these two ideas to explain. And the idea is like this. Even before God gave us the Torah, our forefathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, even before also Noach himself, they learned Torah. Whatever they learned, what was the text that they learned? I don't know. But they learned Torah anyway. Like, for instance, in Noach, in Parshas Noach, we see that after Noach left the ark, after the flood, etc., he left the ark, he made sacrifices to God. And the Torah says that the sacrifices were of those pure animals. Actually, from the impure animals, there was only one couple in the ark. And from the pure animals, there were seven couples. How did Noach know what a pure animal is, what an impure animal is? There was no Torah over there. So our sages learned from there that he already knew Torah. He had the Torah. Again, what was the text? I don't know. But whatever, he learned Torah. But to some degree. So if our forefathers already had the Torah, why was it necessary a whole Matan Torah? Why was it necessary a whole Shavuos that God appeared in the Mount Sinai and the Sinai was with all kinds of thunders and lightning? Then what's the whole fuss about it? We already knew it. We already had it. But the idea is that, again, there was a disconnection between the spiritual world and the material world. And through the giving of the Torah, what did God do? He connected the two. So if Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, whomever, before the giving of the Torah, fulfilled the commandment, very nice. It was a commandment. But it wasn't really the same category of a commandment that we can fulfill. And through this, we're going to understand the second part of the slide. The second part of the slide brings a verse from Shir HaShirim, the first chapter. It says, L'reach shmanecha toivim shemen turak shemecha. I just copied the translation. So whatever, your ointments, your oils, whatever, yield a sweet fragrance. Your name is like finest oil. What is this verse talking about? The whole Shir HaShirim, the whole Song of Songs is a conversation between a man and a woman. And she says certain things and he says certain things. They're like very nice. This is actually representing the relationship between God and the Jewish people. So God is actually telling us, look, your ointments, there's a very nice perfume, fragrance, whatever, however you say it, to what you did. This represents the commandments of the forefathers. Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov were very nice, but they didn't have the essence of God revealed inside of them. It was like a perfume. A perfume is not a thing in itself. It's just a smell of something. Okay, we can say that chemically speaking, is the particles of the perfume, whatever you want. But in a regular, like simple world, perfume doesn't have anything to it. You can't touch it. It's just a perfume, it's just the smell of it, the fragrance, whatever that it produces. That's how our sages show what the commandments were before giving of the Torah. The essence of God was not there. In other words, it's the same thing, but in other words, they were not able to bring down God into the world. Even though they did fulfill commandments, they did the very nice deeds, etc., etc., but those deeds did not bring down God into the world. What does that mean? Our sages bring the example of Yaakov. In the Zohar, it's a book of mysticism, Kabbalah, whatever you want to call it. In the Zohar itself, it says that in Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov, he made a homework with the cattle of Laban, his uncle. And he used some sticks, whatever. If you know the story, fine. If you don't know the story, it's okay also. But he used some wood sticks in order to reproduce the cattle of his uncle. And our sages say in the Zohar that those sticks actually were the same energy, they produced the same energy that any regular Jew produces today by putting on tefillin. The black boxes you put in the arm, in the head, okay, the same energy. However, when a Jew today, he puts on the tefillin are a holy thing. You cannot just throw it like that. You have to be careful with them, very careful with them, etc., etc. And to the point that if one of the tefillin falls in the floor, you have to fast. Okay, it's a whole thing. It's that shows you the holiness of the tefillin. However, when Yaakov finished reproducing the cattle of his uncle Laban, he just threw the sticks away. Forget it. The sticks were not holy. Even though, again, mystically speaking, the energy generated by the sticks is the same, was the same energy generated by our tefillin. However, our tefillin remain or become and remain holy, and the sticks not. Why not? For this particular fact. The energy that Yaakov generated was like a spiritual thing. And the spiritual things were separated from the physical world. That means he was not able to bring down spirituality into the world. The sticks were just wooden sticks. Forget it. And the energy remained over there, whatever, somewhere in the spiritual world. That's the commandments and the fulfillment of the commandments of the forefathers, of our forefathers. But now, after the giving of the Torah, God gave us the strength to fulfill mitzvahs. And when we fulfill a mitzvah, a commandment, that energy comes down into the world. We are able to reveal the essence of God into each one of our thoughts, our speech, our actions, the commandments, etc., etc. That's why there's a comparison over here between fragrance, which doesn't have a thing in itself, and oil. That's why the verse finishes, your name is like finest oil. What's the difference between oil and fragrance? Fragrance is, again, it's not something that doesn't have any in Hebrew you say mamashus. It's not something with doesn't have a material thing. An oil is something. And you can pour it out, etc., etc. That's why actually the verse says, I don't know why this translation I copied it from whatever, from Sefaria. But Shemen Turak Shemecha, your name is like finest oil. I wouldn't translate like that. Turak means like poured oil. Your oil is really poured oil. But whatever. I'm not a master in English and in Hebrew and in Spanish and nothing. Whatever. This is one idea of what's the importance of Matan Torah. The importance of Matan Torah is that God gave himself into the commandments. And today, by fulfilling the commandments, we can connect spiritual world with the material world. And of course, the same thing happens backwards. South can go up to the north. That means that we can refine ourselves and we can elevate ourselves into spirituality. But before that, before Matan Torah, before Shavuos, it wasn't possible. Second. Let's go to the next one. This idea is pretty much connected to the previous one, but it's like a different turn to it. I explained before that Anoichi is the first word of the Ten Commandments and means me. Like Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, I'm God, your Lord. There are many explanations into this idea, so I just wrote it in a very simple sentence, but it's really deep and long. The point is that when God said Anoichi, what he did actually was to like inject his essence, his name inside of each one of us. The moment, as I'm going to explain later also, but the moment of giving of the Torah is the moment of general conversion from the children of Israel into the Jewish people. Two different things. How did this conversion happen? This conversion actually happened by, again, God injecting himself, his name into each one of us. And generation after generation, not just the people that were standing over there, but generation after generation, the essence of God is inside of each and every Jew. What does that mean? Sounds nice, but what does that mean? Okay, so there's one of the names of God. Each name of God represents an expression of God. God has infinite names. Actually, the Ramban, Nachmanides, says that the whole Torah is just names of God. You have to combine the letters, whatever. But the point is that one of those names expresses, is called the essential name of God. Shema Vayit, that's what it's called usually. Yud Kei Vav Kei, four letters, I wrote them over there. The four letters of God, a Yud, a Hey, a Vav, and a Hey. This represents the essence of God. And this is the name that God injected into each one of us in the precise moment of the giving of the Torah. What does this name represent? This name represents all the three tenses, so to speak, past, present, and future. Was, is, and will be, which in Hebrew is called Haya, Hoyve, and Hiye, which are the same letters of this holy name. That means that this name is just those three tenses combined all together, was, is, and will be all together at once, at one time. Of course, at the same time, of course, for us regular human beings, it's impossible to be at the same time was, is, and will be. For us, it's three different times, three different situations, etc., etc. But God is infinite. So for him, there's no difference between past, present, and future. This again represents the infinity of God. And this is exactly what God like injected in each one of us. What does that mean? In practical terms, there's nothing, I wrote it over there, there's nothing that can stop a Jew from fulfilling the mitzvah. We're really infinite. Actually, when we say Shema Yisrael, there's a positive commandment of saying Shema Yisrael in the morning and in the night. Once one time when one once in the morning, once at night, we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu. I on purpose didn't copy the rest of the line because right now we're not going to learn that. But the one of the ways of learning this particular prayer is Shema Yisrael. Hear you, Jew, each one of us. Here, I'm going to teach you something. Havaye Elokeinu, Hashem, this name of God that represents infinity was, is, and will be. That would represent that nothing can stop a Jew from fulfilling the mitzvah. This name of God is Elokeinu. The word Elokeinu, besides being a name of God, the word Elokeinu means our strength. It's based on a verse in Yechezkel, Eilei Ha'aretz, the strong people in the earth, whatever. I'm just bringing the proof where it comes from. It's not an idea that came up in my mind. The point is that when you read the phrase in this way, you're saying something very powerful. What you're saying is, you're talking to yourself and not talking to somebody else. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was saying Shema Yisrael in Parshas Vayechanan, he was talking to the Jewish people. Very nice. And he was preparing Jewish people to go into Eretz Yisrael. Okay. But the point is that when we recite it, we're talking to ourselves. And we're trying to become conscious that there's nothing that can stop me from fulfilling a mitzvah. There are many things that can stop a person of doing whatever. If I would like to buy the penthouse in the Fifth Avenue in New York, I'm sorry, I can't because I don't have the money. Very nice. Yeah, but I really want, and there's nothing that can stop the will. Yeah, but you know what? You have to have the money in your bank account. Otherwise, impossible. I personally don't have it, so forget it. It's impossible for me. Right now, at least, I think for my whole life, probably, it's impossible. So how can you tell me, Shema Yisrael, oh, very nice, nothing can stop me at the wheel. No. We're just talking about commandments, mitzvahs. There's nothing that can stop me from fulfilling a mitzvah. And even, maybe I shouldn't even say this, but whatever, I'm just sharing ideas. Even if a person will ask, wait a second, there were times that it was very difficult to be a Jew. Thank God today it's not so difficult. It's pretty easy. Nobody kills you, nobody stops you, etc., etc. But whatever. There were times that were it was very difficult. And they would kill you if you do a mitzvah and if you show yourself, etc., etc. So how can the rabbi come and say that nothing can stop a Jew because Shema Yisrael and the God is our strength and ta 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 ta? How can you say that? And the answer. Not a nice answer, but it's very simple. Even it's called Mesiras Nefesh, even giving your life for God, that's a mitzvah. That's also commandment. Parshas Kedoshim, Kedoshim to you. You have to be holy. Yisrael, that's the verse that we learn, and we will sanctify, God will sanctify himself in the Jewish people. So even dying for being a Jew, that's also a mitzvah. So if for whatever reason, you cannot fulfill a certain amount of mitzvahs, and somebody even kills you because you're a Jew and you're fulfilling a mitzvah. By being killed, you're fulfilling a mitzvah. So at the end of the day, nothing stopped you from fulfilling a mitzvah. Again, it's not a nice answer, but it's like a logical thing to think about. The point is that all of this happened on Mount Sinai. This idea of God injecting himself, the Anoichi, his essence connected to each one of us, and we becoming conscious of this idea, this happened precisely in Shavuos. And why did God do this? Because the reason why he wanted to create the world, as I mentioned before also, is to have a dwelling place down here. This is one of the explanations our sages bring about this. God wants to live down here. How do you do that? Through the Torah and through fulfilling mitzvahs, commandments. So that's why by being conscious of these ideas of being infinite, being having infinite strength, etc., etc., by being conscious of this, we're actually fulfilling the reason itself that God decided to create the world for. It's not like a maybe it sounds like a small thing, but it's not. Because we, as partners to God in the whole creation, we are helping him, so to speak, to do what he wants. And without us, so to speak, he couldn't do it because this is what he wants. He wants us to do it. Not because it's forced or because he needs or whatever the case is, but just because he wants us to do this, by us doing this, we're enabling him, so to speak, to reach the reason why he created the world. So by living, just like as I wrote over there, by living a life according to the mitzvahs, that generates his dwelling place down here. And that's why he injected actually his essence into us, for us to have the strength to create this house, so to speak, for God. Okay, now let's go to the last part, so to speak, to understand a little bit of laws and things we should and we should not do in Shavuos. First of all, Shavuos is a Yom Tov, it's a holiday, and many people are accustomed, used to hear that for Shabbos you light candles. But people sometimes don't know that for Yom Tov we also have light candles. So first thing that we have to know is to light candles for Yom Tov. This would be Tuesday night. Each part of the world has its own times, etc., etc. But the point is that we have to light candles. There's a special blessing that we say when we light candles for Yom Tov. There are two actually blessings, two actually two blessings. One blessing is to light candles of the festivity of Yom Tov, and the second blessing is called Shehecheyanu, that we thank God that He allowed us to reach this particular happy moment, etc. This is first of all candle lighting. I put a drawing of two candles, but in each case you have to see, you have to ask your rabbi, whatever, how many candles you should light. The custom is, the tradition is in Chabad to light one candle for each child. So you, a regular woman lights two candles plus one candle for each child. And one more maybe detail that people don't really know, not everybody knows, that if a man is alone and he doesn't have a woman, doesn't have a wife or whatever the case is, he has to light candles also. He can light one candle, it's okay, it's not, doesn't need more than one, but he has to light candles also. The house has to have lights, but that's already a loss of lighting candles for Shabbos and Yom Tov. Okay, another tradition, common tradition in Shavuos is to stay up learning the whole night. There's a specific book called Tikkun Leil Shavuos, which it's not so big, can take a few hours anyway, that brings a little piece of each part of the Torah, the beginning and the end of each parasha, of each weekly reading of the Torah, of each one of the five books. Then it has a little bit of Nach, that means the part of Nevi'im, prophets, and part of Suvim, and also has parts of the Talmud, the Mishnah, and Gemara, and Zohar. It's basically like saying, okay, let's learn the whole Torah, so to speak. Of course, if you had to learn the whole Torah, it's going to take more than one night. So it's impossible. So our sages chose parts, little pieces of each part of the Torah. That's called Tikkun Leil Shavuos. Many people don't learn this. The tradition in Chabad is to learn it, is to say it, at least to recite it. You don't really learn it inside. You just say it, or whatever. Sometimes it's only in Hebrew, and people don't, not everybody understands Hebrew. So many, many synagogues around the world, they arrange talks and lectures of rabbis or whatever throughout the night in order to like help the people that don't know how to learn by themselves or cannot learn the Tikkun Leil Shavuos. But that's fine. That's okay. Why do we stay up all night? The story is, this is brought in the Midrash, that when God was given the Torah, was ready to give the Torah, the Jewish people fell asleep, and they did not wake up early in the morning to receive the Torah. The day before, they went to sleep, and they just didn't wake up, and God had to wake them up in order to receive the, to give the Torah, to receive the Torah, etc., etc. God to give, and the Jewish people to receive. So in order to correct this, so to speak, mistake, and I'll explain this in a minute from a mystical point of view, very simple and very nice, I think. The way to correct this fact that the Jewish people fell asleep the morning of the giving of the Torah, so we stay up all night. What's the mystical like point of view to this idea? When a person goes to sleep, the main thing in his life stops being the body and starts being the soul. The soul goes up and whatever, there's a whole judgment over there and perceives God, and etc., etc. So the idea of going to sleep by the Jewish people, this is one explanation. The idea of going to sleep represented, oh, God is given the Torah. So we have to do something spiritual because Torah actually is a spiritual thing. So we have to become, so to speak, spiritual in order to receive the Torah. That's why people went to sleep. And God woke them up and said, no, you didn't get the point. Just like the story in the Talmud that we learned before, you didn't get the point. The Torah, it's a physical thing for the physical world, for our problems, like physical, regular human beings. So don't go to sleep. You should be awake. That's one idea. But the point is that usually we stay awake the whole night. Now, one small note on this idea. If a person is going to stay awake just looking at the roof or whatever and reading the newspaper and how the sports, etc., etc., better go sleep. Why? Because staying awake means that you're going to learn Torah. Okay, it can be that you cannot You're not able to learn the whole time, every single second. Okay, that's fine. Go to the bathroom, eat something, drink a coffee. That's okay. That's fine because everybody needs, the head just goes crazy the whole night learning. Okay, I can understand that. But if you're just going to like spend your time just talking about sports, better go sleep because the next day you're going to be like fresh in order to daven, to pray, whatever. So staying awake all night is not the thing in itself, it's the learning staying awake all night. Okay, another tradition of Shavuos is to hear the Ten Commandments. This is the Torah reading by day. You read the Ten Commandments. And the Rebbe actually was very strong, telling all the years, bring the children, bring the women, bring everybody else to the synagogue to hear the Ten Commandments. Another tradition of Shavuos is to eat a dairy meal during the morning of the first day. As you probably know, out of Eretz Israel, out of the land of Israel, we have 2 days of Yom Tov, 2 days of holidays. The first day, we eat a dairy meal. We have to be careful. I'll explain to, I actually wrote it over there, so it's easier to see, but I'll explain anyway. But one very important note. You probably know there has to be a separation between meat and milk. There are different traditions, so to speak, on how long you wait between milk and meat. Between meat and milk, usually people wait 6 hours. There are some that wait 3 hours. I don't know, ask your rabbi. But between milk and meat, there are also different traditions. Some people just wash the mouth and keep eating. Some people wait 1 hour. Ask your rabbi what's the proper behavior for you. In Chabad, we wait 1 hour. We eat the dairy meal. Of course, you have to do Kiddush first, you have to sanctify the day, etc. We eat the dairy meal. Some synagogues make a whole very weird thing full of all kinds of dairy things. Okay, that's nice, very nice. But the quote unquote mitzvah, the idea is just eat something dairy. You can eat the whole day if you want, but whatever. We eat something dairy, and then in Chabad, we wait for 1 hour. You have to wash your hands or your mouth if they're still dirty with milk, and then we eat a meat meal. The truth is that the meal of meat is more important than the dairy. So if you're just going to fill your belly with delicious dairy things and then you're not going to have any more space for meat, I don't know. It's doubtful that you're doing the right thing. But whatever, ask your rabbi again. This is just my humble opinion. Why do we eat dairy meal, I'm sorry, in Shavuos? One of the ideas is, I wrote over there, that the Torah was given in Shabbos. Everybody agrees that the day of the week when the Torah was given was Shabbos. It's related to what the Torah is, what Shabbos is. It's a whole thing. I'm not going to go into that now. But the point is that when the Jewish people received the laws of kashrus, one of the laws of slaughtering, etc., etc., is that the knife through which you slaughter has to be kosher also. And of course, before the giving of the Torah, the Jewish people were actually not Jewish, as I explained before, and I'll explain in a minute on the end of this slide. So their knives were not kosher. Were not kosher. Even Moshe Rabbeinu was not Jewish, so he had to convert also in the giving of the Torah. So their knives were not kosher. And in the morning, I just received the Torah. There was no time to kosher all the knives and all the stoves and other. So they just ate dairy and that's it, because it's easier, so to speak, the koshering part than with meat. That's why, remembering this fact, many, many people eat a dairy meal. Another explanation is that the word milk in Hebrew is spelled chalav. I wrote it over there in Hebrew also, which when you add up the letters of the word chalav, ches, lamed, and beis, you have 40, the number 40, and that represents the 40 days that Moshe Rabbeinu was on Mount Sinai, etc. That's why, remembering Mount Sinai, etc., etc., we eat a dairy meal. another tradition that some people do it and some people don't, and actually some halachic authorities prohibit this particular tradition. Whatever, there are different halachic authorities. Go ask your rabbi again. Some people put flowers all over the synagogue in Shavuos. Some people even put them in their houses, the flowers and green grasses, etc., etc. And the reason for this custom, for this tradition, I'm sorry, is that our sages say that the Mount Sinai was filled with flowers. If you ever saw a picture of the place, and go back just a second, you see here that you have a small map. Probably Mount Sinai was in the somewhere in the south of the Sinai Peninsula. There's no grass over there. There are no flowers over there. There's nothing over there. It's just sand. So the tradition is that in the moment of the giving of the Torah, the whole mountain became full of flowers and grass and a beautiful mountain. So in order to remember this, some people put flowers in the synagogue for Shavuot. Another reason given for this tradition is that the day of Shavuot, it's a day of judgment for trees. So we put flowers and things connected to grass and trees, etc., etc. Another tradition that I did not see people in Chabad actually doing this, but it's written in many places, that people read the book of Ruth, whatever. It's a very small book, very, very small book. And there are many reasons given for this. One reason is because Ruth was actually a great, great grandmother of David HaMelech. And David HaMelech, and actually the Baal Shem Tov also, they passed away in Shavuos. And because David HaMelech's great, great grandmother was Ruth, so we read something connected to David HaMelech, to King David. That's one reason given. And the other reason given is because Ruth actually was a convert herself. And the day of Shavuos is the day of the conversion of the Jewish people from the children of Israel into becoming actually the Jewish people that we are today. So, as I was saying before, even Moshe Rabbeinu was a non-Jew before the giving of the Torah, and he became a Jew at the giving of the Torah. Actually, the Talmud itself learns the different process, the different details of the process of conversion from the giving of the Torah itself. From there, we learn it. Actually, they went to the mikveh, and of course, they had circumcisions if they were men. They went to the mikveh, and there's another part of it, so to speak, that we cannot do today. They brought a korban. They brought an offering also. In Mount Sinai itself, it says that Moshe, I'm sorry, sprinkled the blood of the offering on the whole people over there, standing in the giving of the Torah. But today we cannot do this because we don't have a temple that should be reconstructed speedily nowadays. But that because we cannot do it, so that part of the process is that, so to speak, left out. But again, going back to roots, because the day of Shavuot was the day of conversion of the whole Jewish people, so we learn a book that talks specifically about the conversion of Ruth.